This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. CBD, an active compound in cannabis, is becoming popular for treating things such as chronic pain and other ailments. Some proponents of CBD make some interesting claims about the healing virtues of CBD. Let me list a few things for you. It heals brain injuries. It treats Crohn's disease. It slows Parkinson's. It slows Alzheimer's dementia. And it halts psychosis. Those are just a handful of the things that CBD is supposed to solve. Joining us is a researcher in the Anesthesiology Department and Chronic Pain and Fatigue Research Center at the University of Michigan Medical School, Kevin Behnke. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, tell us what CBD is.
So CBD is cannabidiol. It's a non-intoxicating component in the cannabis plant. And at this point, there's a lot of excitement about it, as you said, about its therapeutic potential. And a lot of this is coming into place after the FDA-approved Epidiolex, a CBD-based product for childhood epileptic disorders like Dravet syndrome. So because it was shown to be effective in that, there's now a lot more opportunities for people to use it at this point, not necessarily the Epidiolex itself because it's so expensive, but because now CBD is FDA approved for some indication, people are thinking, okay, where else can we use this and how can we use it effectively?
One of the big questions is, in Michigan, is CBD oil or CBD products of any kind, is it legal?
Kind of. It's really a squishy space to be in. So if CBD is coming from hemp, the cannabis plant that has less than 0.3% THC in it.
Which then, is the intoxicant.
Yep, exactly. Then it may be legal. In the 2018 Farm Bill that was recently signed, industrial hemp production was legalized. But how that's going to be regulated, the FDA hasn't really weighed in a very strong way. So they're taking public comments this month about it. But at this point, there are food products that contain CBD. There are gummies and supplements and tinctures that contain CBD. And there's just so much swirling around, and it's also a very lucrative market. So we have all these forces at play that are complicating the situation.
It's Wild West right now.
Absolutely.
What do we actually know about CBD as a medication?
It's a great question. Like I mentioned, so the FDA did approve CBD for childhood epileptic disorders. That being said, in terms of other conditions that there are many of these claims about, the body of research is quite limited. So at least in humans, in terms of animal studies, cell studies, CBD does seem to have anti-inflammatory activity. It does seem to be a useful agent in arthritis. And in a few studies in humans, it seems to have anti-anxiety properties, but those are high-dose, single-dose studies. So people given CBD once and seeing what happens.
So not a lot of research.
Not a lot of research.
Not enough research anyway. And years away from FDA approval, because that takes a long time. That's a process in itself.
Likely, yeah. It's also the type of thing, though, that because there's all that preclinical research where the mechanisms of action seem to be promising, people have been saying, well, because CBD is for a long time has been a Schedule I substance because it comes from the cannabis plant, this lack of research has actually clamped down what we could know about the therapeutic benefits of this compound. And so similarly to what happened and is what is still happening in the medical cannabis space, we're in this position where the policy about the access to CBD and medical cannabis, for that matter, is so far ahead of the science. So as scientists, we're kind of scrambling to catch up to do the best that we can.
How much is the opioid crisis contributing to this interest in CBD?
I think it's contributing quite substantially for a couple reasons. So one, just the human cost of the opioid crisis is so horrific that people want to find something that they can do in its place. And two, many of the chronic pain medications and interventions that a lot of people use either are expensive or not accessible. So things like, good physical therapy, massage, acupuncture, yoga, things that are evidence-based, there's issues with access and out-of-pocket expense. In terms of medications, those come with pretty significant side effects a lot of times. So opioids, obviously, overdose and death. But a lot of other medications, too, they have effects on mood, on appetite, on just all kinds of things as well as pain. And they don't work that well in every individual. So people are still going to, you know, have to figure out what's best for them and often end up taking multiple medications. So when you have compounds like CBD that are available that are known to be quite well tolerated and fairly safe in a lot of people, in fact, the safety clinical trials that have been done on CBD really suggest that it is extremely well tolerated and has few associated adverse events, we end up in this situation where, you know, people out of desperation want to go for compounds like CBD. The other thing is, on the opioid side of things, there's actually a clinical trial that came out that found that people who are recovering from heroin addiction, so an opioid, obviously, when they are given high doses of CBD, that seems to reduce some of their cravings for heroin. And so part of this emerging body of research that's coming out that people are so excited about, because if CBD has this therapeutic potential and it has few side effects, this is a really wonderful substance that people could potentially use. And I think what's happening is many people are just jumping the gun and going into that as a DIY situation.
And that brings me to this question. I'm sure a lot of people are asking their physicians about it. What are physicians recommending at this point?
So that depends a lot on the physician. I'm not a physician, I'm a PhD, but my stance at this point when I talk to many physicians is, let's go with a harm reduction situation. So we know that CBD is well tolerated, but we also want to make sure that people are using it in a responsible way. Starting with a low dose of a product that is known to be certified for safety and potency. So we know what's in it in terms of, yes, the CBD matches what the claim is, as well as it doesn't have heavy metals, pesticides, etc. We suggest doing that if the patient is going to do it. And we also really suggest keeping a open line of communication between the patient and physician, because that's the basis of a successful relationship there. And I mentioned the safety and potency issue because just recently a news report came out stating that many, many CBD products are contaminated either with heavy metals, with pesticides, with solvents from the extraction process. And so because this is such a Wild West situation, it's really important that people are using a product that they know what's in it.
But how would you know? I mean, is there some place that's actually certifying them, saying this, we've tested it, this batch is great, and there's no problems with it, or is it we're just relying that the label's right?
So that's where the independent third-party testing is really important. So companies that they send their products out to somebody who's not internal, and that produces a certificate of analysis that indeed shows you all of those things. But, you know, because it is a Wild West situation, I mean, you can go on Amazon and get hundreds of products of different products, and it's just a difficult place to be as a consumer as well, and as a physician for that matter, because if the patient comes in and says, hey, I want to try CBD, unlike a pharmaceutical where a doctor can say, okay, let's go with this one. It's gone through all the FDA testing. It has the good manufacturing practices, all that stuff. They just don't have that for CBD in the same way. And the one FDA product with CBD that is approved, it's only for that limited indication, right. And it's incredibly expensive. You know, if people are going to be paying for this, it's much different to pay like $50 for a bottle of CBD than it is to pay thousands for Epidiolex.
So some NFL players are pushing for the league to loosen up the rules to allow CBD. Battered football players want access to it because of the claims about the substance. It's said that CBD can do everything from preventing seizures to treating all these kinds of chronic pain issues. Why is it so popular among them?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons for this. One is that these athletes, their bodies go through an incredible amount of trauma. you know, the practice that they do, the hits that they take on the field mean that many of them have lifelong injuries. And to stay in the game, a lot of the time, many of them are given painkillers, including opioids. And I think many of the retired athletes, I've spoken to a couple, but in the news that I've seen about it, many of them say, you know, this game really took it out of my body. And the medications made things worse. I couldn't feel what was happening. So I would push past my limits, do whatever it is. And CBD doesn't have that kind of side effect profile. As we've talked about, it's pretty well tolerated and it's not intoxicating. So I think there's that aspect of things. And then also just the mechanistic side of things. We know that CBD has many of these effects in non-human studies. And so people are thinking, okay, let's just see what's possible there.
Gets back to that desperation you were talking about.
Gets back to that desperation, exactly. And I think lastly, the fact that cannabis is becoming increasingly legal throughout the country in many of these states that do have football teams. And because of that, I think there's kind of a mismatch between the NFL policy of, you know, nobody can use this versus the state policy where people can get a license and then go to a dispensary or grow their own cannabis. It's kind of the situation that's playing out throughout the country, but in that microcosm of these athletes who, you know, suffer from a lot of pain.
Sounds like we've got a lot to learn yet.
Yes, we do.
That is Kevin Behnke. He's a researcher in the Anesthesiology Department and Chronic Pain and Fatigue Research Center at the University of Michigan Medical School. We've been talking about CBD. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we'll look at what causes toxic algal blooms in Lake Erie. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The growth of algal blooms in western Lake Erie led to shutting off the drinking water in Toledo in 2014. The blooms could lead to toxins in the water under the right circumstances. Algal blooms are a growing problem in the lake. It's been blamed on excessive fertilizer being applied to farm fields and manure runoff from livestock farms in the Maumee River watershed. The Environment Working Group and the Environmental Law and Policy Center investigated the sources of the nutrients feeding the algal blooms and found the problem is aggravated by many more so-called factory farms. Joining us now is Madeline Fleischer. She's senior attorney with Environmental Law and Policy Center. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how big is the Maumee River watershed?
It's pretty big, which is part of the reason the scope of this problem is so large, is it goes all the way from western Lake Erie, reaches even into Indiana. So it's thousands of acres.
Right, and includes part of Michigan, too, as I understand. Mm-hmm. Your investigation found that there are a lot more factory farms in the region than there were just a few years ago. How many more?
There's been a significant increase, 20, 30, 40% over the last decade. And that's key in part because a lot of these big operations don't have permits because they come in under the number of animals at which you're required to get a state or a federal permit.
I want to define this whole idea of factory farms, those also confined animal feeding operations. Give me an idea what we're talking about when we say factory farms.
Sure. So these are farms that it is not your, five cow, 10 pigs, that kind of thing. These have hundreds or even thousands of animals when you're talking about something like poultry, but these permitting requirements don't kick in until pretty high levels.
So they produce a lot of manure, whether we're talking about pigs or chickens or cows. So what happens to that manure and other animal waste that's produced on these farms?
You're correct to call it waste. I think that's the right way to look at it. And the way that most of these operations get rid of this waste is they have some storage on site where they keep it, but ultimately they put it on fields through what's called land application, which is theoretically supposed to be for growing crops. But really it's waste disposal. And you can see that, in terms of some of the rules around specific to manure that aren't necessarily keyed towards how much you actually should be putting on there if you're really trying to grow corn or soybeans or whatever it might be.
So I'm not following you there. The farmers tell me that they put the manure on, they incorporate it into the soil to be a fertilizer. That's exactly what it's supposed to do to help their crops. That fertilizer is the same thing as causing these algal blooms. So what's wrong with that?
Well, we know it's not staying on the field. Scientific consensus is that about 90% of the phosphorus that's causing these algae outbreaks comes from either commercial fertilizer or manure. And what that really means is probably during heavy rainstorms, even though it's been put on the field with the idea that it'll be taken up by crops, it's getting washed off. And that's really, something that's getting worse as climate change is causing more of these rainstorms and more severe ones. So it's something where, these may have been practices that worked, 20, 30, 40 years ago and were the norm, but they need to be revisited.
Your report says the amount of manure that's produced and applied to farmland in the watershed went up from 3.9 million tons each year to 5.5 million tons. Do we have any idea what percentage of that is actually getting into the Lake Erie, western end of Lake Erie?
It's more than it should be is really what I can tell you. And part of the problem here and what we're working on through this report and otherwise is getting the states and the federal government to try to figure that out in a more coherent way. The current approach has generally been to sort of throw money at the problem and hope that that some of these big operations will voluntarily change what they're doing. And we all can see that that's not working because we're still getting the same amount of phosphorus in the lake, same algae outbreaks every summer. And there's a mechanism under the Clean Water Act where you're supposed to, use the information you have, get more data if you need it, and try to figure out where this is coming from and where you actually need to focus your efforts to get reductions, including through some robust regulation.
Now, let me push back a little bit because late last year I talked to the Ohio Farm Bureau and they say voluntary efforts are reducing the problem as evidence that the cyanobacteria toxins have not caused drinking water systems to have to shut down since 2014. Your investigation seems to be coming to a different conclusion. Why is there that disparity?
I think the credit there goes to the drinking water treatment folks. The reason that Toledo's drinking water and others has been protected from the algae outbreaks that are still happening is because they're putting in the monitoring and the treatment they need to deal with the toxins, and that's costing their ratepayers millions upon millions of dollars, with more to come. So that's a back end fix, and it doesn't mean that the front end problem of the pollution is getting any better. And in fact, Ohio EPA's own data shows that there hasn't been a reduction in the amount that's going through the Maumee or otherwise.
You did find that the amount of phosphorus added by chemical fertilizers on the farm field has actually gone down, but the overall phosphorus levels are rising because of these factory farms, these confined animal situations. Why have we seen that change? It sounds like they're making progress in one area while not making progress in another area.
I think those trends don't necessarily have to do with what anyone's been working on to address phosphorus pollution. It's just sort of, I think, where the agricultural economics are driving things. It's folks are raising more swine and more poultry, and apparently they're finding enough money there to make it worth it to build new facilities and to expand. And to us, that means that's exactly the place you want to look to do more to make sure that as these folks are expanding, they're not making the problem exponentially worse.
Well, what can be done to reduce the problem? I mean, if there's a demand for more chicken and more pigs and more cattle, the market forces are pretty strong there. Is there anything that can be done?
You got to have a robust set of rules. There are you know, common sense agricultural practices that you could institute across the board that could really make a dent. You know, one pretty easy example is that the rules for how much manure you can put on a field actually let you put on a fair bit more manure than you could commercial fertilizer. It's got a looser set of rules. So you can put on more manure than any agronomist would tell you you actually need to grow crops. And that's something where there's an existing rule about it that just needs to be fixed so that this is really being kept to, you know, to keep folks honest that you're not just using these fields as really a dumping ground.
Is this something the Ohio, Michigan, or Indiana regulators can do or have the political will to do?
Well, I think it's an open question whether they have the political will. I think, at least in Ohio, where I am, we're seeing some movement. I think Michigan is expressed some interest and has been ahead of Ohio in terms of declaring Western Lake Erie impaired under the Clean Water Act, which gives them some more federal regulatory tools to use. So there's some movement there, but I'm not sure it's moving far enough or fast enough to help really solve the problem.
Madeline Fleischer is senior attorney at the Environmental Law and Policy Center. That organization, along with the Environmental Working Group, identified an increased number of factory farms responsible for manure pollution causing toxic algae blooms in Western Lake Erie. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Glad to be on.
Do tax incentives work to draw business and create jobs to the point states actually recoup the investment and bring in more tax revenue? Well, the answer is it depends on the incentive. When cities like Detroit and states like Michigan are foregoing millions or tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue, or in a couple of cases preparing to offer incentives in the billions of dollars, a lot of folks wonder what in the world are people in government thinking? I was reading in Governing Magazine about some recent research out of North Carolina State University, which looked at all of the incentives offered by 32 states from 1990 to 2015. That basically covers 90% of incentives for the whole nation. Leading that research was Bruce McDonald, an associate professor at North Carolina State, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what did you want to learn with this research?
Our goal was to really get an understanding of how financial incentives impact fiscal health. We know quite a bit about what drives a state's fiscal health, but in terms of kind of understanding that impact of financial incentives, we really don't know too much. The literature and the previous research out there on financial incentives has been predominantly focused on the economic side of things, and even that's relatively sparse. Yet states have a tendency to make these large offerings, and so we really just kind of wanted to understand what kind of impact those offerings really do have for the people and the governments that offer them.
So people haven't actually looked very carefully about whether there's even economic benefit with these incentives?
Unfortunately, they haven't. There's been some studies over the years that have looked at different aspects. Usually they focus on a part of the product that the incentive brought into the state. Did it impact the employment level? You know, something kind of along that kind of line. But they are one-off situations rather than a broad understanding of what the incentives actually do for the economy.
So in that case, what kind of factors did you use in determining whether incentives work?
So what we did is we looked at four different categories of factors that are going to drive a state's fiscal health. This would be the governmental characteristics of the state, the political environment of the state, its economic environment, as well as its demographic characteristics. And then we then kind of imposed the financial incentives onto that set of factors in order to derive out the impactors that the incentives are having.
Well, let's jump to the bad part. What sort of incentives seem to be the worst kind of government investment in private enterprise?
Unfortunately, it tends to be the incentives that are related to research and development projects.
So like tax credits.
Exactly, which are things that we would usually kind of expect. We have a hope that R&D products are going to have a large payoff. But if we think about what types of businesses and types of projects are done on the R&D side, there's a huge risk for the business as well. And so that risk really can be pushed back over to the government side. That is, they're costing the state fairly significantly in terms of their fiscal health and stability.
You also noted that property tax abatements weren't all that great.
Right. So if we think about property tax, we can use the abatements to make it a little bit more feasible for somebody to come into our communities. But that's also a large chunk of revenue that local governments and state governments rely upon for their budgets. When things go bad financially for the state, it's property tax, which is going to be the most stable form of revenue. And so we're basically removing that stability that the state has to rely on. So ultimately, it does have a fairly negative impact for the state.
A lot of state incentives are tied to job creation, although Michigan has failed in follow-ups on some of those incentives. That is, they didn't always claw back the incentives when the jobs never materialized. What did your research reveal about job creation tax breaks?
Job creation tax credits are probably the one unique area of financial incentives that actually pays off for the state. And part of that is when the state is incentivizing business to employ more people, there's an immediate payback to the state itself in terms of income tax revenue coming in. We've removed the person perhaps off of whatever state-funded programs they've been on in the meantime. And so there's a fairly direct and fairly significant impact that the job creation tax credits have that no other form of incentive really does.
I probably should have asked you this earlier, but of the 32 states, was Michigan included?
Michigan was included. So Michigan overall is a kind of middle-of-the-ground state in terms of financial health. You know, not doing great, but it's also not necessarily doing too bad.
There's the argument that government incentives are not the highest priority for corporations. They look at things like whether there's a skilled labor pool, the cost of labor, the corporate tax rate, quality of life in a community. All of those things seem to be more important according to one ranking. Are states putting too much emphasis on incentives?
That's a tough question to answer. We know businesses pay attention to the incentives, and all things being equal, the incentives can be the determining factor. We think of an instance like Amazon HQ2 from last year. One of the factors that got incorporated into it was Amazon was going around looking at the quality of life, looking at the environment as well, because they want to be able to bring people into work in that area for the company. But as New York found out when they pushed back on kind of saying, we're not going to give you the incentives like we had thought we would be able to, you know, Amazon had the capacity to pick up and leave. And so it might not be the only factor, but it is certainly a factor for the business as well.
So we talked about job creation tax breaks. What are some of the best kinds of incentives a state could offer that would pay off in a good return on investment and keep the state healthy?
Unfortunately, the only one that does have a payback for the state is the job creation tax credit.
Huh. So bottom line it for us, are states and cities competing with each other to attract these businesses to their own detriment?
Oh, absolutely. I think part of it is the argument that politicians feel like if they don't go into the competition, the public is going to be displeased with the job that they're doing. And so that we almost kind of from the political standpoint have to do the incentive. But that at the same time, it is hurting the people back in the states and the districts where they are from. And so maybe it's not necessarily the best idea for them to do in the first place.
What do you think would happen if a state decided, you know, we're going to rein in everything except for these job creation tax credits? Would that work?
I think depending on the state, it would help. And so the largest amount of tax credits that we see typically take place are along the East Coast, where you have states heavily competing for businesses that need some type of international access. So North Carolina versus South Carolina for auto industry, for example, or North and South Carolina versus Alabama, where there's an ocean where they can ship the cars and vehicles out, bring in the parts they need, but it also gives them access around the United States. And so it wouldn't necessarily require one state to kind of stop offering incentives. You would need to have several of these major players to stop offering incentives.
We've seen some regions in a state that will work together. Several towns or several counties would work together and not compete against each other for the same thing, that thinking that the just drawing the plant to the region would be beneficial for everyone, right? So Could states do that? Can you imagine, Great Lakes states binding together and saying, look, you want to put a plant here, that's great. We're not going to compete with each other to do that, though.
I think it would be a good thing for them to do that. There's a lot that the Great Lakes states have to offer outside of just financial incentives. You know, there's an amazing workforce. You have a great climate. You have strong cities. You have a fairly vibrant culture. You have things that large businesses are looking for when they're trying to make those decisions on where to locate. And so saying, you know, here's the rest of us, let's pay attention to that, can still appeal back to some of the businesses as they're trying to make that decision on where to locate or where to expand to.
Well, I'm always a skeptic. I can't imagine that actually happening, but I like the sound of it anyway. Bruce McDonald is an associate professor at North Carolina State. He was the leader of a research team looking at the value of tax breaks and other incentives to lure or retain businesses. Thanks for telling us about your research.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Still to come, a look at how drone technology is being used in agribusiness.
We have specialized sensors called multispectral sensors that allow us to look at the greenness or the health of certain plants.
And we'll talk about how cover crops can improve soil health for farmers.
They are pulling nitrogen out of the soil at a time when that nitrogen might otherwise just be available to be lost to the groundwater through leaching.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Technology on the farm is advancing all the time. GPS helps farmers plant more efficiently. Equipment communicates with computer data to determine where and when it's best to use chemicals and so on. The most recent tech starting to be used on farms is a drone. With the right sensors, drones can check on crop pests, check on soil moisture, and even look at plant growth in a more standardized way than a spot check by a farmer. Here to talk about how drones are used and might be used on the farm in the future is Robert Goodwin. He's a senior geospatial analyst at Michigan State University's Department of Geography, Environment, and Spatial Sciences. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So drones have become popular for these overhead videos and still photos and even news coverage. How common is it for drones to be used in agriculture?
Drones in agriculture are becoming extremely common. Basically, drones have taken off in various places of agriculture, primarily cash crops right now.
And what do you mean by cash crops?
By cash crops, I mean corn, wheat, soybeans. But more often now, they're being used for other specialty crops. In Michigan, we are one of the most diverse states, agriculturally speaking. So we have things like grapes for wine and juice. We have peaches. We have all sorts of different fruits and all sorts of different agriculture, truck crops and whatnot that we can use drones for.
What's the most common way they're being used right now?
Most commonly for plant health, I would say. We have specialized sensors called multispectral sensors that allow us to look at the greenness or the health of certain plants. So that's the primary focus right now. Farmers will generate something called an NDVI, or Normalized Difference Vegetation Index, and that's sort of the standard way of looking at the differences of health in a field, whether that's from disease, whether it's from pest, fungus, whatever.
So what does it actually read? What data does it collect that actually helps the farmer determine the health of a plant?
So the cameras that we use, they record energy in different bands. Typically, the bands that are important are the red band and the near-infrared band. We can see in the red, you know, we can see visible light as humans, but we can't see out into the near-infrared. Fortunately, plants are reflective, highly reflective in the near-infrared. And the differences between the red light reflectance from a plant, which is consumed by chlorophyll, you know, red reflectance in a plant is very low in a healthy plant. So it's absorbing a lot of the red light. At the same time, it's reflecting a lot of the near-infrared light. And these differences, as chlorophyll decreases, red light reflectance will increase, yet near-infrared light reflectance will stay fairly high. And when we ratio those bands, we can determine small differences in plant health.
Let's talk about some of the limitations. I mean, it takes training to use a drone. There are limitations by the FAA as far as how they're used. And the technology still has some limits in the amount of weight a drone can handle and how long it can stay in the air. Let's start with the training. How common is it for farmers to get the training right now?
I think it's still relatively uncommon for farmers themselves to get the training. There's a lot of thought out there that it's my farm, I don't need the training, although it is the right path and the legal path. But there's a lot of crop service companies and a lot of vendors out there that are sort of filling in that gap to actually do the flying. I think it'll increasingly become more common for farmers to do it themselves. But you think of farms and the sizes of farms these days, and they would have to employ people full time just to do flying in a lot of cases.
Yeah, how much of a financial incentive right now is there to buy yet another piece of equipment and hire someone?
Well, exactly. I mean, the return on especially cash crops is pretty low. And so farmers are looking at this as a cost per acre. And if that cost per acre gets too high, then it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to invest in it. But a lot of that depends on the capabilities of the aircraft. So right now, aircraft can only fly anywhere between, say, 15 and 40 minutes. If you're talking about a quadcopter or some other multi-rotor aircraft, they can fly longer if it's a fixed wing, but still not cover large, large areas like maybe a manned aircraft can.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the possibilities of these drones right now. Is the industry adjusting as the potential for greater use by more industry and agriculture is happening? Are they making adjustments to these planes, and what are their limitations in the technology right now?
Certainly. There's sort of parallel technological improvements occurring right now. Battery chemistry is a big one, and obviously that's more important than just for drones. Autonomous vehicles and that sort of thing, electric vehicles rather, are very dependent on battery chemistry. So as battery chemistry improves, that'll improve the efficiency and the endurance of our drones. Fixed wing can be a problem because it's more difficult to take off and land, but there is a new technology that's sort of becoming more common, is vertical takeoff and landing planes, where a plane will stay in the air much longer than a rotorcraft because it has airfoils and it wants to fly. It can fly without the use of those. It can at least glide, so it's more efficient. But taking off and landing has always been sort of difficult. So we now have vertical takeoff and landing planes. It takes off vertically, transitions to horizontal flight, flies for a very long time, and then on its way back, it transitions back into a vertical landing and comes down automatically. So that plane can fly for anywhere from 30 to 40 minutes, which is usually a little bit longer than rotorcraft. More importantly, it can fly faster. So we're talking about, with a rotorcraft flying for 30 minutes at the maximum height allowed by the FAA, you might fly for 30 minutes and cover 80 acres. Whereas with this plane, you could cover 300 to 400 acres. And that's a game changer for especially cash crop farmers when you have fields that are a mile square or larger.
You mentioned the FAA restrictions that can limit the use of a drone. What are some of these restrictions? You mentioned altitude. What other restrictions are there? And are any of them being loosened anytime soon?
The altitude is actually the least important right now, in my opinion. The most important regulations that are sort of limiting are beyond visual line of sight and flying over people not involved in the operation and also flying over moving vehicles. Obviously, there's safety concerns with those, but if there's going to be large-scale agricultural acceptance of drones, using these beyond visual line of sight is important. And right now, you can apply for a waiver from the FAA to get that, but it's a bit of a process and you aren't guaranteed to get it. And if you're flying anywhere near urban areas or close by even small airports, it's likely you'll be denied.
Well, there's a big company who's wanting to change a lot of those rules. The farmers might be getting some help from somebody like Amazon or other delivery services.
Certainly. I was at a presentation at the GIS conference, and there was a gentleman talking about just that. If he solves the problem for package delivery, because package delivery will require beyond visual line of sight, it'll solve the problem for everybody. So if the economics work there and they can convince the FAA that this loosening will help out that industry, then it'll only reap benefits for everyone else.
You're holding workshops to not only show farmers how to fly drones, but also to use data collection and geographic data analysis so that drones can actually do something useful beyond having an eye in the sky. How's that being received?
Pretty well. As far as I know, we're the only ones right now offering drone training where we actually not just teach the people how to fly the drone, because that's, to be perfectly honest, the easy part of the equation, but we're teaching people how to process the data and then even more importantly, analyze the data in geographic information systems so we can start creating reference data that goes back into things like precision agriculture. It's one thing to get up and fly a drone. It's an entirely another thing to derive useful information from that drone.
So we've talked about a lot of developments that might be coming. What do you think is the next big development that might be most helpful for farmers thinking about using drones to get some good information about their crops?
Right now, we're doing some research with some professors at Michigan State University in plant, soil, and microbial sciences, Addie Thompson, Eric Olson, Marty Chilvers, and some others, that are looking at things like phenomics. And we're using LIDAR instruments, which are laser scanning techniques to build topographic surfaces and plant characteristics information, and also hyperspectral imagery, which is looking at not just a few bands of energy in reflectance, but looking at hundreds of different bands reflected in different areas along the spectrum. And that technology is very expensive right now. But as that matures a little bit more on the drone side, we'll be able to look very specifically at plants, say one plant from another, and say that's phosphorus limited or that is nitrogen limited or that's got a fungus. Right now, that's a little difficult with the broadband multispectral data that we're using right now.
I noted in an article you wrote that some farmers might get better benefit from it now than others. For example, row crop farmers might not find it as useful as, for instance, Christmas tree growers. Why would Christmas tree growers have a better advantage using drones?
Right now, what they want to know mostly in the Christmas tree community is where are their trees, how many trees they have, where they are, and how tall they are. And with drones right now, it's a fairly straightforward exercise along with some GIS processing to locate a georeference point for every tree, so that's your count, and then also extract the height. And if they know the height, they know how many 7-footers they have, how many 8-footers they have. They can plan their harvests. They can do all sorts of things. Where back in the farming, it's a little more difficult to say, okay, if I fly over this cornfield and I see areas that are not as healthy as others, we're not exactly sure why that is. In most cases, you don't know exactly why that is. You actually have to go in the field and say, oh, okay, it's not healthy because there's a fungus, or it's not healthy because there's corn rootworm. It's not healthy because it's nitrogen limited. But you don't know that strictly from the imagery at this point. You have to sort of guess. Now, a farmer will know generally how their field is reacting, you know, what's going on in their field at any one time. But it's harder. It's a harder exercise. Whereas with Christmas trees, it's like, well, we're just doing counts and we're doing heights, and they can get a lot of benefit out of that.
Robert Goodwin is a senior geospatial analyst at RS&GIS, a research and outreach group within the Michigan State University Department of Geography, Environment, and Spatial Sciences. Thanks very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I recently visited Michigan State University's Kellogg Biological Station at Hickory Corners near Battle Creek. Phil Robertson is a university distinguished professor of ecosystem science, and he was showing me some of the test plots for an upcoming environment report story. But then he also started talking about a farming method that's not very often used in Michigan, but it might be helpful in the effort to reduce the greenhouse gases that cause climate change. Here's that conversation. We're standing in front of a field here, and I see some stubble of one kind of crop and some green stuff growing in between it. What am I looking at?
We're standing in a field in the early fall. It's a wheat field. It was harvested a couple months ago, and so we're looking at wheat stubble. But in between the rows of wheat that have been harvested are green plants that are about 2 or 3 inches tall at this point, and these are clovers. This is clover that was planted into the wheat after it was harvested, and this clover will grow all fall and will be about probably ankle to calf high by the time winter sets in. The clover will overwinter, and come spring, as soon as the soil warms up and conditions get right, the clover will start growing. Probably that'll be in late March, early April. And so prior to when the corn crop is planted in late May, this clover may be, you know, as much as knee high. And at that point, it can then be mowed, and the green material, which now contains a lot of nitrogen, can provide nitrogen then to the succeeding corn crop as it decomposes over the next few weeks.
Now, that's not typical, because if you're going to grow clover and you're going to mow it, it makes good hay, right?
It does make good hay, but as a cover crop, it's typically not taken off as hay. It's typically left in the soil to provide fertility for the following cash crop.
So what's the advantage of doing something like that for both the environment and for the farmer?
For the environment, cover crops have a number of advantages. One of them is that because they are planted at a time of the year when there are no crops on the soil surface, they are pulling nitrogen out of the soil at a time when that nitrogen might otherwise just be available to be lost to the groundwater through leaching. That is, there's nothing to prevent in a plowed field or in a bare field during the wintertime as the snow accumulates on that field and then melts and pushes its way through the soil the following spring. It's carrying a lot of the nitrogen that's residual from the previous year's crop with it. And that ends up in groundwater and streams and eventually in lakes like Lake Erie or in the Gulf of Mexico if we're in a different watershed. And so the cover crop will keep some of that nitrogen in the system, which is a good thing, even if it's fixing nitrogen from the atmosphere. As these clovers are, it's still picking up nitrogen from the soil.
But that's not the only thing it's doing, right? I mean, you've got a green plant here. It's taking in CO2?
Well, that's right. It's taking in CO2, and that CO2 is being fixed into crop biomass, as we call it, into the plant material, the leaves and stems, and also the roots of these of these plants, so that when the plant is killed and it becomes organic matter that starts to decompose, that sequesters carbon in soil. The carbon that's in that plant biomass, some portion of it will stay in the soil and be an effective greenhouse gas mitigation activity.
So we're talking about greenhouse gases here that are not getting into the system. That means less problems with climate change. Is this a common practice?
Cover crops are not commonly grown in the U.S. At this point, largely because of the cost. At most, we're looking at several percentages of U.S. cropland under cover crops at any given time. If you fly over the Midwest in the spring and you look down, you'll see mostly brown fields prior to being put into plants, put into crops. But occasionally you'll see a green field. And in some cases, that field might be alfalfa, which is a perennial crop, which would stay green all year. In other cases, it would be a field with a cover crop that would then be plowed under and the nitrogen and carbon added back to the soil.
If it's more expensive, I mean, they get an advantage in that they keep more nitrogen in, that's less fertilizer. There's the advantage to the environment because there's less CO2 being released. How much more expensive is it for a farmer?
Well, it's a whole different crop, right? And so you can imagine how much it costs to plant a corn crop. And those upfront costs are also faced by a farmer planting a cover crop. The seeds are not necessarily cheap. And when they're sown in the fall, it takes tractor passes to put them in. And then it takes tractor passes in the spring to mow them and otherwise manage them to make sure they get into the soil.
Well, since the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, we've understood that a cover crop is good for reducing soil erosion as well. So does that not figure into their calculations?
So there are other ways to manage against soil erosion, although cover crops are certainly the most effective way to do so. Planting cover crops in highly erodible ground or even permanent cover, perennial grass cover, on parts of a field that are at a particular slope is quite common, not as common as it should be. But the bottom line is that from year to year, erosion costs are difficult to assess, and it's difficult to justify planting an entire farm to cover crops to mitigate against erosion, potential erosion losses, when there are other ways to deal with it.
As there's more public pressure on industry and agriculture to reduce the greenhouse gases that are changing our earth, do you think farmers will reassess maybe in the future cover crops or other mitigation activities like that might become more common?
We know that cover crops are an efficient mitigation activity, as we know that no-till and fertilizer management are equally important. And there's certainly tools in our toolbox for climate change mitigation on the farm. And whether or not they become practices that are employed in the future, I think will depend on where we as a nation put our eggs, so to speak, so that if we are truly interested in mitigating by all means possible, as we should be, then we should be paying farmers for that mitigation capacity, and I think farmers are eager to help. I've never heard a farmer say that they wouldn't do something that's good for the environment if they could afford to do so.
That's Phil Robertson. He's a researcher with Michigan State University, and we are at the Kellogg Biological Station. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Next week on Stateside, we'll take a closer look at some of the programs Governor Whitmer vetoed in the state budget. Also, what can we expect with the coming U.S. Census, and is Michigan prepared? And a conversation with Michigan Radio's John U. Bacon about whether California's plan to allow college athletes to be paid will find a foothold in states like Michigan as well. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.